Welcome to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine's Fiction Podcast. I'm EQMM's editor, Janet Hutchings. Our December podcast featured a Christmas story, and we thought we'd kick off 2022's podcast season with a New Year's tale of sorts. The story begins on the best-loved American summer holiday, July 4th, but finds its conclusion and renewal at the turn of a new year. Written by a former math teacher who also writes Western fiction, the story first appeared in our Department of First Stories in January-February 2021. Here is Ken Lynn reading his story, Stray.
From the front porch, her mother and little sister saw Catherine collapse to the ground. She had been standing alone in the yard near the flagpole, looking down the hill toward the river on the eastern horizon, waiting for the 4th of July fireworks to begin. Full darkness had just set in. The other children, cousins and neighbors, ripped around the yard playing at some chasing game. Throughout the neighborhood, pops and bangs from firecrackers burst out in a weak prelude to the coming spectacle. There was blood and panic, frenzied uncertainty wrapped in shouted questions with no answers. The ambulance arrived quickly after what seemed like an eternity. Her small, motionless form on the long stretcher rushed away amid the unstoppable explosions and flashes above. Her mother was with her, inside the red and white box on wheels with lights flashing in all directions, its siren fighting to be heard between the booms of the fireworks. They were followed by a train of vehicles filled with relatives and friends, all in a state of disbelief and bewilderment over what had happened so suddenly in the midst of their carefree summer evening celebration. At 10 in the morning, the room was flooded with sunlight and the lingering scent of burnt popcorn and stale beer when Ike Wendell's phone rang. He pulled the sheet from over his head and reached across the bed to the pocket of his jeans. "Are you hungover?" Malona said, sounding disgusted already. "A little, I guess. Why? What's it matter?" "Were you alone last night?" "You know I was. You gonna start that up again? Celebrating the 4th of July all by yourself?" "You know I was, thanks to you." "What did you do besides think about me?" she teased. "Just stayed home, had a few, played some music, loud, watched the fireworks out on the deck. What was I supposed to do with you gone off with your parents for most of the weekend? Aren't you getting just a little too old to be doing that anymore?" "This'll be the last time, I swear," she said. "Once I move in, we'll be together all the time."
"You tell them, Malona?"
"Not yet. As soon as we get back."
"They ain't gonna like it," he said.
"Nothing they can do. I'm 23.
"They can bitch at you a mess."
"Won't matter. Hey, you had the news on yet? You heard about that poor little girl?"
"I've been asleep. No, what?"
"She got hit with a bullet in the head last night, just standing in her front yard waiting for the fireworks to start up. Wasn't more than a mile or so from your place or my parents. They say she's in bad shape. It's all just making me sick. Said it was probably a stray bullet from somewhere. Maybe some damn fool just thinking he was celebrating."
"No, I hadn't heard about that," he said as he stood up, hustled out to the living room and reached for the remote.
"Gotta go, Ike. Talk to you when we get home tonight." Before she hung up, he had already turned on the television and found the local news channel. He watched and waited until the story about the little girl came on. The victim was identified as 9-year-old Catherine Stillwood. She was listed in grave condition at the local hospital. A short interview with the girl's tearful aunt was followed by an appeal from the county sheriff for anyone with information to call. He remembered everything from the night before. He wasn't blackout drunk and never had been. While grilling a couple of burgers, he'd started with beer and then switched to the hard stuff straight from the bottle. The music was pulsing from his party speakers as he danced around the deck, feeling happy about the recent path his life had taken. Malona was moving in soon. He had a decent job, driving around delivering auto parts. The pay wasn't too bad and the hours were good. Maybe they'd get married in a year or so, eventually have some kids. He had even entertained the idea of going back to school, taking classes at the community college at night. He couldn't see any of the other houses through the thick cluster of white pines, but heard firecrackers and what sounded like gunshots from somewhere nearby.
Feeling festive, he went to his bedroom and retrieved the revolver he'd acquired the week before. Wilona didn't know he had a gun. She didn't like guns, but after talking with Cap Rice, he bought it anyway, certain he'd be able to convince her of its worth. With Wilona moving in, they'd need one just in case someone came snooping around late at night. His place was isolated and not in the best neighborhood. Just last month, the cops had busted a bunch of meth heads three doors down the road. He would have her safety to think about, not just his own. Waving the gun in the air, he danced around the deck, feeling safe and powerful. He hadn't fired it since the practice shots out at the quarry the day he brought it home. Just as full darkness set in, he heard another set of bangs from beyond the trees. In reply, he raised the gun upward at an angle less than vertical and shot three times. By noon, he was out the door, heading for town in his pickup. He stopped at the drugstore and bought some aspirin, a bottle of Coke, and a copy of the local newspaper. Back in his truck, he washed down three pills and read the front-page article about Catherine Stillwood, learning little more than he had from the television report. From the address given in the article, he knew exactly where the girl lived. He'd driven down that road more times than he could count. It was at least a mile from his place, probably more. There was no way a bullet could travel that far. Besides, there were other gunshots in the air that night, lots of them, likely from somewhere much closer. He cruised out of town and found his way past the house, up on a hill not more than 30 yards off the road. A black sedan was parked in the gravel driveway, but there was no sign of anyone outside. The only thing moving was a flag flapping on a pole at the center of the yard. He drove back into town and headed for Uncle Sam's bar and grill. In the dim light inside, he struggled to see if Cap Rice was there yet. Cap never sat in the same place 2 days in a row. To Ike, it was one of the few things that seemed irrational about Cap. He found him tucked in a corner booth, hunched over a bottle of beer, engrossed in a Sudoku puzzle. When Ike slid into the booth, Cap put down his pencil and pushed the puzzle book aside. He raised his bottle to catch the barmaid's eye and held up two fingers. "Hey, kid, happy Saturday," Cap said. "Same to you, man," Ike replied. "You do some celebrating yesterday for the big holiday?" he asked as he brushed his fingers through his close-cropped white hair. "A little. Wilona was out of town." "How's that new gun working out for you?" "Okay, I guess. Tried it some. Things got a little kick to her. Takes some time getting used to." "Yeah, I guess, if I keep it, that is. Wilona, she don't like guns." "Well, a whole lot of little gals is like that. They just don't understand, unless you explain it to them in just the right way." "I guess so," Ike said. The barmaid came with two bottles, winked at Cap, and asked if they needed anything else. "Just your company, darling," Cap said with a sly grin. "Can't you see I'm working hard?" she said with a smile. She scurried back toward the bar. "Well, kid, you got to inform a young girl like Wilona all about the world we live in today, about how a man's got to protect what his any way he can. 'Cause there's a whole lot of folks invading our country that mean to do us harm and take what's ours if we let down our guard." "Yeah, I sure know that. And the meth heads, too." "That's right, kid. You've got to be prepared." "I'll talk to her," Ike said. "She'll see." "Well, now, if she don't, if that's going to be a problem between the two of you, I can buy that gun right back from you. No problem, kid." "Thanks, Cap. Appreciate that. But I guess I'll keep it for now," he said, then gulped down half his beer. "You hear about that accident?" Ike said, looking away toward the bar. "With that little girl, I mean?" "Yeah, Ike, I did hear about that. It's a damn shame. A little child like that. That's what I keep thinking about, so young, with her whole life ahead of her. Like you called it, though, it was an accident. No different, I reckon, than someone getting hit with a foul ball at a baseball game. Weren't no intent to harm. Folks just doing what they was doing and someone gets hurt." "I guess that's the way to look at it," he said, staring down the neck of his bottle. "Maybe she'll pull through." On his way home, Ike took a slight detour down the road past the little girl's house again. A white SUV was parked in the spot on the driveway where the black sedan had been. At the next house, he spotted a sheriff's department car and two deputies standing in the yard, talking with an older couple. Farther up the road, he saw another official vehicle and a deputy standing on a front porch knocking on the door. At the next intersection, Ike came to a full stop, then made a cautious turn toward home. He spent most of the afternoon slouched on the sofa, dozing off at times while watching a marathon of a reality show where people risk injury performing silly stunts. When the 6 o'clock news came on, he waited anxiously for an updated report on Catherine Stillwood's condition. There had been no change. They showed a recent school photo of the girl and interviewed neighbors with their reactions to the tragic event. Another appeal for anyone with information to come forward was followed by a report on celebratory gunfire, otherwise known as Happy Fire. A thin man wearing black-framed eyeglasses interviewed a scientific expert in a white coat. "A bullet fired into the air," she explained, "can often travel up to a mile or so, shattering windows or penetrating roofs and seriously injuring or even killing people." She went on to explain the physics involved with shooting a bullet into the air, and why shooting at an angle is even more dangerous than aiming straight up. "So, what advice would you give to people who are tempted to celebrate by shooting a gun?" the reporter asked. "Don't do it. Shooting in the air is never a good idea, because what goes up must come down." He didn't really understand all the technical stuff she had spouted off, but it made him remember a lesson on gravity from 8th grade, where the teacher would repeatedly say with increasing volume, "What goes up?" to which the class would chant together in reply, "Must come down." Ike was half asleep on the sofa in front of the television just before 10 o'clock when Wilona clattered in through the front door, startling him awake. "Damn, girl," he said, "you scared the hell out of me busting in here like that." "What, you think I was a burglar coming to take all your valuable stuff, whatever that might be? Only thing in here worth taking is probably your TV, and even that's old." "Well, it's nice to see you too," he snarled. "Didn't you miss me?" she said, snuggling next to him as he sat up. "You know I did." "You got the news coming on this channel?" she said. "I want to hear if there's anything new on that little girl's condition." "No," he said as he reached for the remote and turned it off. "Hey, what did you do that for?" "I'm tired of listening to that mess. We haven't seen each other for days. Can't we just talk?" "Well, okay," she said. "I tell you, I'm just sick over that poor little girl. I've barely eaten anything since I heard about it. And her poor family, what they must be going through." "Sure," he said. "It's bad." "I am just so glad that you never bought that gun you were going on so much about. And why some damn fool would go shooting off a gun on the 4th of July is a total mystery to me." "Maybe he just felt like celebrating," he said. "What, a firecracker isn't loud enough for him?" she said as she sat up and crossed her arms. "He's got to go one better, just so he can feel like a big man." "Well, it's not like he done it on purpose, Wilona." "Just about. What did the idiot think? That bullet was just going to keep on flying into outer space forever? Or maybe just automatically land in a tree or a pond somewhere?" "Well, it's like a guy down at Sam's said. You've been hanging out down there again," she barked, "listening to that old barfly, what's his name, Rap?" "It's Cap. His name is Cap, and he knows a lot about the world from the experiences he's had in life." "You can't possibly believe half the trash that comes out of that man's mouth." "How would you know? You only met him once." "Once was enough. Same with all the rest of that bunch down at Uncle Sam's. Worthless. Never amount to anything. They're the only friends I've got around here." "Well, that's a sad statement on your life, isn't it? People who you just sit around and drink with in a bar aren't really your friends." "What's that got to do with anything anyway?" "Like I said, I'm just glad you didn't let that nasty old man talk you into buying a gun from him. Maybe it's not such a bad idea. We might need it for protection." "You know what you are," she said, standing up. "You are gullible. You sit there drinking a few beers, listening to some fool talking all smooth and calm-like, and you believe every word he says. You tell your parents you're moving in here yet?" "No," she said as she headed for the door. I swear, Ike, if you had an extra brain like the one you've got, you'd still only be a half-wit. In his dreams that night, he was down at Uncle Sam's, and all the regulars were there. Wilona marched around the room, pointing her finger, scolding everyone. His eighth-grade science teacher appeared, and the bar morphed into a familiar classroom where Ike himself led the chant of "What goes up must come down." The rows of desks were filled with students of different sizes and shapes and hair, but every one wore the face of Catherine Stillwood. His science teacher became Cap Rice, who took over leading the rhythmic chant, "What goes up must come down." At first light, he woke, certain the bullet that had hit the little girl was his. Late in the morning, he drove to the hospital and wandered through the hallways and waiting rooms, acting like he belonged there. He sat at a table in the snack bar for a while, nursing a soda and a bag of pretzels, watching the people drift in and out until he spotted the woman he'd seen interviewed on TV. The little girl's aunt paid for a wrapped sandwich and a bottle of water. From a safe distance, Ike followed her to a waiting room where she joined a group of half a dozen others gathered in a corner. Taking a seat on the opposite side of the large room, he picked up a magazine and pretended to read it. He watched the aunt sit next to another woman who waved away the offer of half the sandwich. The two women had the same eyes and nose, and Ike figured the other woman was probably Catherine Stillwood's mother. She was small and thin and wore an expression deep with worry, weariness, and grief, unlike any he'd ever seen. As they talked, he strained to listen but couldn't make out any of what was said. Everyone in the group was well-dressed, like they'd just come from church. Other people came and went, seemingly offering their condolences. It reminded him of the visitation at the only funeral he'd ever attended when his own grandmother had died years ago. But here, the body, attached to an array of wires and tubes, was still breathing, out of sight down the hallway behind the secure double doors. When he couldn't stand to watch any longer, he put down the magazine and left. At home, he wrapped the gun in a faded and frayed flag-patterned beach towel and stuffed it as deep as it would go under the seat of his truck on the passenger side. On his way to the lake at the state park, he tried calling Wilona for the fourth time that day, but she still wasn't picking up. When he got there, the lake area was crowded with cars and trucks and people still enjoying the long holiday weekend. He cruised down the lakeside road but failed to find an isolated spot where he wouldn't be seen throwing the wrapped gun into the water. Not knowing what else to do, he headed back for town. On the way, he took a detour past the house where Wilona lived with her parents. The driveway and street were crowded with vehicles, and he could see a trail of smoke rising from behind the tall white fence in the backyard where they kept their grill. There was music playing low, and he heard what sounded like the splashing of water in the pool. Parked behind Wilona's car in the driveway was a new-looking bright red Mustang that he was sure belonged to the boyfriend she'd had before him. On Monday morning, Ike arrived more than 20 minutes late for work. Chuck, his boss, looked him up and down as he hurried in through the back door. "Rough weekend again?" he asked. "Sorry," Ike said, "forgot the alarm." "Getting to be a habit, Ike. You need to fix it." "Absolutely. Won't happen again." Out on the road in the company van, he kept the radio tuned to a local station while he made his way along his regular delivery route. After unloading at two stops, he was back behind the wheel when he heard a teaser about a coming report on the little girl's condition. Figuring he'd miss it if he was unloading at the next stop, he drifted past the familiar auto shop, turned, and drove down a tree-lined road with no traffic. He stopped the van on the shoulder of the road and waited. When the news started, his phone rang. It was Chuck. He turned off the radio and picked up. "Ike, where the hell are you?" "Almost to Baker's garage." "Oh yeah? Well, looks like you missed it. He just called and said he saw you drive by a few minutes ago. Now get your head out of your ass and get back there. He needs those parts right away." When he turned the news back on, they'd already shifted to traffic and weather. It was almost 6 when Ike pulled into the gravel parking lot behind Uncle Sam's. Facing the opposite direction, he parked next to Cap Rice's rusty white pickup. He pulled the gun, still wrapped tightly in the towel, from under the seat and got out. Knowing that Cap didn't keep anything of value in his truck and never locked it, he opened the passenger side door. He slipped the bundle under the seat, then locked both doors and closed it up. Inside the bar, he couldn't spot Cap anywhere, so he asked the barmaid if she'd seen him. "You haven't heard?" she said, looking wide-eyed and sounding excited. "The cops were here about an hour ago, handcuffed him and dragged his ass right out of here."
"Wait, what, Cap?"
"Yeah, they told him right out loud they were arresting him for the unlawful sale of firearms." Mike stayed for a beer to help him calm down and heard three more versions of the event from the guys seated at the bar. When he returned to the parking lot, a towing rig was pulling away with Cap's truck loaded on the back. On the way home, he heard a breaking news report that Catherine Stillwood had died. Just after 8 o'clock in the evening, Ike saw a state police car creeping up the lane toward his deck. He turned off the television, cranked the shades closed, and pulled the curtains together. Someone knocked at the door on and off for several minutes before finally giving up. After hearing the car pull away, he sat silently in the dark room for nearly an hour, wondering what Cap had told them, certain they had found the gun by now. In the early morning, he left a message on the office phone saying he was sick and would be out from work for a few days. Most of the furniture in the house belonged to his landlord, so he packed what little he owned into the bed of his truck and covered it with a tarp. At the bank in town, he withdrew all but a few dollars from his account. With no clear idea where he was going, he hit the road, driving down interstates and back roads, generally heading west and south, sometimes back east again. He alternated staying at cheap motels and campgrounds, sometimes even sleeping in his truck. Here and there he took on odd jobs for a day or two, doing grunt work for cash. He ate as cheaply as he could, usually only twice a day, conserving his cash to pay for the gas needed to keep moving. His phone didn't ring much, but when it did, he didn't pick up or even check to see who it was. After a while, he kept it turned off most of the time, and when he failed to pay his bill at the end of the month, his service was terminated. By early August, he'd somehow wandered his way into the small southern town just north of the Florida Panhandle, where he knew his cousin lived. Guy was surprised, but not all that happy to see him. They'd never really been that close, but after talking long into the night, Guy offered to let Ike stay in the spare bedroom of his apartment, at least for a while. After a few days, Ike found a job at a fast food restaurant close to the apartment. He sold his truck and walked to work every day. Guy seemed happy to let him stay when he started to contribute to the rent. Ike seldom watched television reports or looked at a newspaper. He'd watched enough true crime shows to know that if they were looking for him, he wouldn't be all that hard to find. But if they really were trying to locate him, he didn't want to know. If they caught him, he'd go peacefully. During dark, quiet moments, he thought about the stray bullet that had hit Catherine Stillwood and how the word stray didn't seem to fit. When the bullet left the gun, it had followed a definite path, not wandering or zigzagging off before striking its tragic target. He thought about how he and Cap had called it an accident. But what was a true accident? He'd heard someone say once that most accidents could somehow be easily prevented. When he was on cleaning duty at the restaurant, he would watch the wild packs of toddlers running and spinning in the playroom. He often wondered how the young mothers could be so easily distracted, not stopping their children when their playful ramblings evolved into an out-of-control frenzy destined for injury. On his days off, he would often sit on a park bench near a busy intersection, watching the children heading for school. He imagined himself ready to spring into action if the crossing guard showed the slightest sign of neglecting his duties. Out for an evening walk, he would caution children on bicycles and skateboards not to mingle with traffic or try dangerous stunts. Some of the kids heeded his warnings. Others told him in vulgar terms to mind his own business. Most just ignored him. By late September, he'd grown close to a woman at work. At 30, Dawn was a few years older than him. She was a soft-spoken single mother who always cautioned her 4-year-old daughter, Emma, in a kindly way. On a late Saturday afternoon, After they'd both worked an early shift, they walked Emma to the park. As they stood and talked while watching the child play, Ike noticed that Dawn wasn't looking at him. Her eyes never strayed from her child. He felt safe with her, like a passenger with a driver who could talk without ever looking away from the road, concentrating on the dangers ahead. With her, he watched Emma skip across the playground to the swing set. He watched her sway back and forth, up and down, higher and higher, pumping and smiling with pride and independence, arcing through the air like the upside-down path of a bullet, over and over again. Ike spent a peaceful Christmas day with Dawn and Emma. Along with the carefully wrapped gifts, promises and commitments were exchanged. Dawn understood that he would be leaving for a while, on unfinished business not entirely explained. How long he would be gone was uncertain. He bought a used car the next day. Then, 2 days later, he packed up and headed north for the town where Catherine Stillwood had lived and died. On the second day of the trip along the interstate, traffic had slowed and clustered behind several long trucks, blocking both lanes in their struggle to climb a steep stretch of highway. Up ahead in the right lane, Ike saw a faded red, rusted, and dented sedan rolling on tires that looked almost completely bald. In the back seat, a small head popped up from under a blanket, then disappeared again when a woman in the front passenger seat turned and appeared to speak. Ike pulled up even with the car and put down the passenger side window. He honked his horn and waved, showing he had nothing like a gun in his hand. The man in the driver's seat turned his head and cranked his window a third of the way down. "Your tires!" Ike shouted. Looking confused, the man nodded. A half mile later, as the traffic began to speed up, Ike followed when the car turned off at an exit leading to a service complex. When he caught up with them in the parking lot of the gas station, Ike explained his concern for the safety of their vehicle. The woman stood outside the car next to the man. She was holding a boy who looked to be about 2 years old. Ike saw there was no child safety seat in the back of the car. "I know the tires are in bad shape," the man said, "but we don't have the money to replace them right now." "Look, man," Ike said, "I've been there myself. Please let me get some new tires on there for you right now. There's a tire shop right next door. I'll give you my address. You can send me the money when you're able. Maybe a little at a time." The woman looked at the man and then at the child in her arms. "Okay," he said, "that's very kind of you. We will pay you back, I promise." After a few more minutes of conversation, he gave them some cash to buy a meal in the restaurant at the complex. He drove their car across the lot to the tire shop and paid with his credit card. It would take some time for him to pay it off, but it didn't matter. While the tires were being installed, he found his way to a nearby department store and bought a child's car seat. When he got back, the tires were on, and the workers in the shop helped him figure out how to install the seat. It was just before noon on New Year's Eve when Ike arrived in town. He drove directly to the sheriff's office and parked between two police cars in the lot next to the street. 3 blocks away at the top of the hill, he could see the hospital where Catherine Stillwood had died. He stood with his hands buried deep in the pockets of his winter coat, wondering which window had been hers. Inside, in the foyer, a uniformed deputy sat perched high on a stool at a desk behind bulletproof glass and asked through a tiny speaker if she could help him. "I need to talk to someone about the Catherine Stillwood case," he said. "Just a minute, sir." She picked up the phone on her desk and punched a button. Her mouth moved, but he heard nothing. She hung up and said, "Someone will be with you in a few minutes, sir. Please have a seat." 20 minutes later, a door opened, and he was ushered inside. He sat alone in a private office for 10 more minutes until a gray-bearded man, carrying a mug of coffee and dressed in street clothes, wandered in and sat behind the cluttered desk. He didn't bother to introduce himself. "Sorry about the mess here. This isn't my desk." "I understand you're here to talk about the Catherine Stillwood case," he said. "That's right. My name is Ike Wendell. I believe it may have been my bullet that hit her. Killed her, I mean." "Took you a while to get here, didn't it?" "Yes, sir. I haven't been around. I moved away." Well, son, I'm guessing you don't read the paper or watch the news much, or communicate with anyone around these parts anymore. That case was solved back in late July. Two other men came forward. One of their guns matched up with the bullet that killed the little girl. When Ike left the sheriff's department building, he felt warm and numb in the cold air. Feeling a need to walk, he made his way up the hill, past the hospital and beyond, continuing on with no particular destination in mind. Weaving in and out through the residential streets, through good neighborhoods and bad, not recognizing anyone he saw. He passed by the storefronts of the once prosperous downtown, now filled with tattoo parlors and bail bondsmen. He passed a busy liquor store where people, anxious to celebrate the beginning of a new year, were loading their cars with boxes. Almost surprised, he found himself in front of Uncle Sam's and felt a long dormant habit rise up as he pushed his way in through the familiar doorway. He found Cap Rice sitting alone in the same corner booth he'd occupied the last time they'd talked. "Hey, kid," he said, as Ike slid in to face him. "Happy New Year. Been a while." "Yeah, Cap. Looks like you're doing okay. Wasn't sure I'd find you here." "I would guess you're referring to my little misunderstanding with the law back in the summer." "That's all it was?" "More or less. This dude I hang with from time to time borrowed one of my guns without my knowledge. Claimed to the cops later on he was going to use it to shoot some rats. Turns out one of those rats was the big one he was married to. In the struggle for the gun, it went off, shot himself in the foot. Cops got him to confess what he was up to. Wife gave him my name, dragged me into it. Wife tried to say he bought the gun from me. They said you were arrested. Got me a good lawyer. Cops couldn't prove nothing on me. That's pretty much all it amounted to in the end. I thought it was related to you selling me that gun." "Yeah, figured that's what you might have thought. Cops found the gun in my truck. I still had a registration for it. Figured you must have put it there." "I thought you would have told them I put it there." "Your name never came up, kid. No reason." "I thought it was my bullet shot that little girl." "I figured you might have been worried about that, the way you was talking that day. Tried to call you a couple of times, let you know they got the guy. You never heard what happened?"
"Just today."
"Yeah, turns out he agreed to a plea deal. Got a year or so in jail, probation after he gets out. Said there weren't no intent to harm. Don't seem like much for the life of a little girl." "I reckon not, kid, but that's the law for you. Hey, join me for a drink. Stay for a while. Sit and tell me what you've been up to." "No, thanks, Cap. I've got to get back on the road." "Sure, kid. You take care now. Be mindful of all them drunks out on the road tonight. Happy New Year!" Ike ate a big meal at a chain restaurant. Afterward, in the parking lot, inside his car, he dozed off into a sound and restful sleep. It was past 11:30 when he finally woke. He gassed up his car and headed out of town for the interstate. At midnight, in his rearview mirror, he could see the framed reflection of the bright explosions of red and white and blue in the eastern sky behind him. Somewhere, it was raining bullets.
Stray is copyrighted by Ken Lynn. Music for the podcast was obtained from purpleplanet.com. Mixing and editing for the podcast were done by Kevin Wheeler and Jackie Sherbo. You can subscribe to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine, where you'll find more stories like this one, by visiting our website at www.elleryqueenmysterymagazine.com. Happy New Year!